Welcome to Docs in Orbit, where we feature conversations with independent, creative, documentary filmmakers from around the world. This is Eileen Gückman. I'm happy to present this new podcast that holds a special place in my heart. Last year, we had this great opportunity to take part in Cannes Docs at the Marché du Film and to select a work in progress to feature on Docs in Orbit. After careful consideration, we chose a project that resonated deeply with our interests and our creative sensitivity. So we extended an invitation to The Soldier's Lagoon, a multi-layered film about the Páramo region in Colombia. The film explores many aspects of this land's history, including Simon Bolivar's political legacy, colonialism, and it also sheds a light on how these past conflicts continue to impact the region and its people to this day. The film also confronts the urgent issue of ecosystem preservation, which has become even more pressing this year due to wildfires that have devastated the Páramo region. As a result, The Soldier's Lagoon already feels like an archive or a visual and auditory part of the region's history. Blending evocative and mystical elements, director Pablo Alvarez Mesa reveals the unseen aspects of the Páramo region and connects us emotionally to its past, its present, and its future. In this conversation, we will dwell into these themes, with my personal highlight being the discussion around sound. So it's been almost a year since we met at Cannes Docs for the first time. And I think you were at the editing stage then.
Yes, I was. Well, the way I work is I shoot, because I'm shooting film, then I don't shoot more than like 20 rolls. And then I come back and I look at things. I know I don't edit, but I look and I listen and I take notes and recordings and I transcribe and but I don't edit anything. So at that point, I had the scene that like we showed at Cannes is pretty much like the same scene that ends in the film. So at that, like that area of the film was something that I really liked already. But I knew that after that, I needed to shoot a little bit more just to go into a few other areas. And so I edited a little bit more after. I shot and then I edited.
Actually, this scene was the main reason why we decided to invite you to this podcast, because I don't know, there was something really gripping in it. Like I knew that we'd had a great conversation once the film would be finished.
Good. I don't love pitching films. I think it often misleads filmmakers into wrong kind of associations. And it's like sometimes the wrong energy to bring, but then of course like this one, then it did provide some clarity to me in like some certain areas, and of course then it is beneficial in the production eventually. Like some like support that I needed came from that, so I was very grateful to that. But yeah, I'm nervous about pitching, you know, scenarios.
Oh. Yeah, me too. After Cannes Docs, a few months later, we met again in Montreal this time, and you told me that the film was finished, and I asked you a question. Do you remember my question?
I have no idea. What was
there? I asked you, how do you know it's finished? And I just loved your answer. You just told me, like, well, now I like it. I like my film.
Right.
And I don't know. I guess it makes me laugh because it's such a simple answer, but it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And maybe also because for me, finishing my films is always a struggle. When I'm editing my own works, I'm never satisfied with it until maybe way later when I see them on a big screen. And then I'm like, okay, maybe I did something right, but yeah, it's a it's a difficult process for me, but yeah, you liked it.
yeah. It's like editing is problem solving, right? It's like, it's discovery, it's problem solving. The more you solve problems, the more problems you create. And at some point, like, and that's why I shoot, because shooting is also editing, as well as sound design is creation. It's not just editing sounds or like reduction, it's actually like construction. So like all these things for me are very intertwined. And I don't know, yeah, when the film starts reaching a place where it's like, well, like very early the film starts demanding things, right? Like when you're editing, like the film, first you start putting things in a timeline, and then the film starts becoming a little monster that either wants more things or rejects things. And, you know, it has its own pacing, its own kind of like scope, its own way of understanding things or feeling things. And then I feel for me at the end of the process, it's where I feel that the film is satisfying kind of like my aesthetic and my political and my kind of like questions that I had. And that the film is already like giving me either more questions or more answers. And then that's where I like it. I feel that the film is alive then. It's not complete. It's not perfect. I'm not into perfect films or into complete films, but the film is alive. Like the film feels like a little organic thing. And that's where I'm happy with it. So yeah, it's like, it's I love to be surprised by the work, by the film, but by the work itself. Because the film is just a document of the work, you know, but the document of the shooting that we did, the questions that we had once, and then the film itself is a document of that, you know, of the work that we have done throughout. And so it was lovely to feel that the film is alive, you know.
Llegó como impulsado por el genio que me animaba. Y desfallezco al tocar con mi cabeza la copa del firmamento. Tenía a mis pies los umbrales del abismo.
So this is like just a part of a very long feature film that will be released at some point. But this, the whole project is following the path of Simón Bolívar. So it's actually a very like geographically oriented film. We're passing through like specifically the places through which Bolívar passed and trying to see what happened 200 years later. It's in three parts and I'm just like doing them slowly, but I'm doing them backwards, hoping to end with a good story, with the illusion of liberty, you know, the illusion of a country with dignity. That is the first part. So we'll see what we find.
That's why you kept this one for...
For last. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it ends... Yeah, but the process is like that. The third film is quite violent. Then this one opens with a poem that Bolívar wrote that is called "The Delirium Over Chimborazo." It's a delirium. And we can speak about the poem because it's been contested if it was his or not. So it's like the historians still don't know if it was written by him or if it was the first expression of Bolívar fandom, you know, like if it was like the first, like, you know, like the first piece of making Bolívar, like the, it was published after his death and in a very different style to his writing.
What kind of writing was it?
Beautiful, beautiful texts and beautiful letters and beautiful, very political and very... But yeah, he wrote a lot, but this, the Delirium Over Chimborazo, which is that first... section that we hear in the film is very different in tone to everything else. It's the only poem that is attributed to him, but it's very different. It doesn't sound like him.
Yeah, it felt a bit like French romantics.
It is. Yeah, it's in a very romantic language, and I was debating if leaving it full or not. But it's an interesting thing to fall into the convoluted, like arabesque. Kind of like noodles of that language, and it also reveals, of course, the time and the person. So it was an important kind of idea of a document, of an oral document.
I don't mind if the text is actually written by him or not, because there's a kind of personification of the land, and of the mountain in the text and also in the film, since they're the main characters of your film. So I think it fits well. At the same time, there's a sense of deification in the text.
Yes.
I mean, the land is perceived as a divine experience. So we can really feel this experience and this awe and this love that people were there feel for this land, including you.
Yeah. And that the irony, though, that is that the language is very, like, it does revere nature, but then also sees it as an enemy and sees it as something to conquer and sees it as an object, as an obstruction to the personal goals.
Of course. And that's an aspect that we can also find in your film, with this mix of spirituality and mysticism and violence also. So yeah, that's why I think it's the perfect introduction for the film.
I'm glad it worked. I was nervous to leave it, and I'm happy it worked for you.
So yeah, so we don't know if Bolivar actually wrote it, but I was wondering, do we actually know if he actually climbed the mountain?
They don't know if he climbed it or not. And the reason is because it's 6,000 meters high. It's a very high mountain, volcano. And according to what I have read, there would have been records of his ascent, because he would have needed at least 3 mules and a few people. And what I have been trying to research, I have not found, and they had been keeping records of who went up it, because it was like such an odyssey, like, you know, to go up. Objectively, like, there's lack of data, like, backing that ascent. But what's in a more metaphorical sense, then, of course, Bolivar changed his political methods right after he went through Colombia, when he was like starting to go through Peru. And then he changed his mind in lots of ways how to govern. And then that delirium actually became real. And then his grandeur became very problematic and extremely violent. And again, that's for the fourth film, which would happen in another series. But it is the story of Latin America. It is, and that's the point. It's like, it is by no coincidence, like the seeds for how we feel or imagine ourselves as a country come from these people, and come from how they established a set of relationships and an idea of governance, an idea of a country. So we can just go around, like, that document is there. Like, it is, we are the result of that.
Like I told you in my email, for me, it's mostly a film about the unseen with many layers to it. So, of course, one of the obvious layers of the unseen is the past, the historical past of this region. There are also all these other things that we already mentioned, like mysticism and violence and etc. All of these things we can feel or know about, we can't really see them or film them. So you gave yourself this very challenging task of making a documentary about the unseen or about the off-screen, but without relying on archival footage. And in my opinion, you handle this masterfully. But before we get back to that, I'm really curious about your decision-making process regarding the subject of the film, because I guess that from the beginning, you were very much aware that you wanted to convey many things that you couldn't film,
right?
Especially with the landscape being the main character, and I'd say this minimal visual action that was available to you.
Yeah, and I think it goes in hand with exactly what you're saying about the off screen, and the, like, and that includes the obscene, like what is obscene, and in a kind of historical connotation of the word, and how kind of like in theater, the obscene was what was supposed to be violent, like the violence was supposed to be off the theater, off the scenario. So that connects to another idea that I had always, which is like in Spanish, in Colombia, we have el escenario de guerra. Like when we're listening to the news, they talk about the scene of war, the escenario de guerra, the escenario of the conflict. So the scene of war is always in the bush. It's always in the jungle. It's always like outside of our town squares. Bicentenario deals a little bit with that. Like when we go into the town squares, we're always looking out. But now here in this one, we are there. And then the fog, of course, relates to that, like the density of the like the hard to access object that is the forest, in terms of the theater of war and what happens in it. That also then, of course, relates to that Bolivarian kind of like idea of nature, and sometimes that like makes it as an opposite and as an object to conquer. So that is all together, and the fog and the mist, it's like, how do we see through this stuff? So how do we access the idea of what happens there? Because what happens there is that the young military and the young FARC, or like the guerrillas and the paramilitaries and the gold miners, illegal gold miners, are killing each other, and that happens there, and like it happens under the radar of law, of course, and because it's like it's a place that where all these things can happen. There's and then another aspect, of course, in the film, we're very interested in sound and in ornithology, and then in sound, and how these biologists are recording the sound of birds and the sound of bats. And of course, bats don't see, and they communicate through echolocation. And then that is the sound that is pretty much composing the sound for the film. So it does relate to this thing of like not seeing, but also, and then also like the archives for the birds, that many of the birds that are in the film were not recorded by me. They were archives from the Humboldt Institute in Colombia. And they were recorded mainly, or like in part, like no, the Humboldt, like the archives were started by a man. His name is Mauricio Alvarez, and he made an incredible collection of Colombian sounds that date back to 1970 or so. He used to say that in nature we see very little of what we hear. When you're making a panoramic acoustic soundscape, we hear many, many, many things, but where we're in the jungle, in the bush, in the forest, we see very little. We see greenery and we don't see. But the sounds can tell us a lot about the health or the illness of the forest. In the same way, the amount of archives that we have over a certain area can tell us a lot about the health or the danger of the area, according to how many recordings. And then we saw a very interesting graph, and it is between the times of most conflict, there are least amount of archives. The archives of sounds are a reflection of the state of the violence of the place. That includes the of course, the nature, what inhabits this, but also the human conflict over it. So like that, just the idea of the archive, then in a very multilateral kind of approach, gives us a lot of information over what we don't see.
Just to expand on that, on how the film conveys violence through sound, when the film starts to touch upon these violent events, you use a sound that is very, it reminded me of a helicopter, or I think it was a helicopter.
No, you're correct. Sure. It is actually, yeah. Well, in the helicopter sound came after the drumming, actually. Like the drumming was the initial idea, to have these episodes of violence to be percussive and for the impacts to feel like a gunfight. But then when we were drumming with Stefan, who's like an incredible drummer from Montreal, he was drumming and he was like, I was just with my headphones and I was looking the other way and I was not looking at what he was doing, and he had many different kind of objects to drum on. And it started sounding like a helicopter to me. you know, like his drumming started. So I started emphasizing, okay, Esteban, let's like try to like to work towards that sound. And then in editing, then we brought the helicopter. But then the helicopter came from a story that I heard from two different people. One was a guide up in a mountain, and the other one was an ex-military. And they were speaking about when the fog, because the páramo, the fog can race very quickly, or it can like come down. So when you're hiking the páramo, the area where the film takes place, it is actually like dangerous because the fog is so dense that you lose every relation to the mountains or to the sun or to any kind of location of where you were. And that's why, again, like the Bolívar Passage was quite an important or like difficult trek. But then when the armed conflict was happening, then they would like whichever group was trying to hide from the other group, they would use the fog as an object within the war. So then the páramo was both an actor and a theater within what I was speaking about earlier, because the fog would come in and change the dynamics of the theater of war that I was speaking about earlier. And then the helicopter would have to leave, you know? So the helicopter, and always in Colombia or any country that is in war, and whoever listens to this and comes from a place in conflict, they will relate to the threat of the helicopter over, like flying over. Whenever you hear a helicopter flying over, you know that there's something happening close by with these big helicopters. So that is the impending threat, the constant threat of these territories that are like in so much conflict that these helicopters are, that the conflict can come and can go. But then again, how the environment is participant in that conflict, as in like either hiding the opponent through fog or releasing the fog and then having that conflict there. But yeah, the sound of the helicopter and the drumming as a percussive element to stir the spirit of the viewer, but also the spirits of the place, was an important element and to bridge it to the realities of the place.
Then in contrast, you have all these other scenes that feel very calm, like a very meditative experience. You capture the nature in a very tangible, sensorial way. So we feel very connected to the land, and we can, I don't know, I felt like I could almost touch it.
Right.
So it's very concrete, but also magical at the same time. I think you really managed to capture both.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's just there. That's why.
Yeah, no, the páramo is the most beautiful landscape in the world. Truly, if you have 5 days in Colombia, just like skip the beach, like go to the beach, but then go up to the páramo. Like the páramos are beautiful, beautiful areas with beautiful people, extremely, as we will see in the film, very important to the hydraulic cycle of the region, the entire region. They're beautiful, majestic spaces full of depth and silence, and time is different there. The perception of time, which I try to bring up in the film, the temporality shifts. And then film is a, again, I because what I said earlier, I don't know if we were recording already or not, but I was speaking about work and how these films are like the documents of work, and film shooting on film is not about shooting on film. It's about the process. Like it's about shooting on, and I shoot on Bolex, on hand wound cameras that only shoot 28 seconds. And that moment, or like that presence, that shooting with these cameras, like, you know, that too, with your filmmaking, like it does have a deep connection with time and with the moment. And yeah, like, of course, yeah, the burn, the end, the film ends sometimes spoke in and out. And also that starts introducing some themes for the next film with the red and the spirits. So it's that relates to like working backwards, and how with each film I'm sort of like establishing like motifs for the next film. Even though the next film is already finished, but that 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 is that. And then, of course, like in some areas of the film, we see spectrographs, like the image equivalent of the sound recordings, like and that also relates to the machine, the apparatus, and how these machines are just impressions, perceptions of a place. And sometimes when we see, there's a moment too where we see a lens change in the Tourette, like we see like the lens sort of like swapping around. And it's like that that we're perceiving these moments through an apparatus, and the perception of nature and the perception of time are equally mediated. The perception of history, even though history is written with that very big H, but it is as malleable as what we're perceiving now. And as you said earlier as well, like these films that we're making are becoming documents and are becoming part of the narratives that constitute that history of a place. But these things are subjective. They are imperfect. They are subjective. They are impressionistic. But they're dignified. You know, like they try to be there in a way that tries to see through. And it is a complicit kind of like triangle between the film, the viewer, and the filmmaker. Like I am no longer the film, right? Like the film is on the screen, and then me and the filmmaker and the viewer, and then we create kind of like that space of understanding of the film and the subjects around it. And it's a conversation to be opened. Like now we can speak about it, or we can relate to the film with another object. We can relate to it with another film or with another piece of writing or of audio, as we're doing today and whatnot. I don't believe these pieces or these become kind of like big archives. They just become part of a conversation.
There's one more thing I'd like to talk about. It's more practical, let's say. I think it's very interesting that you're the director, the cinematographer, the editor of the film, but also its producer. It's self-produced. And I think we can really clearly feel that you had this creative freedom. Like you say before, you could choose when the film was finished.
Yeah, besides making films, I am a camera person and I am an editor for other films. So that's sort of like how I live my life, editing other people's films, shooting other people's films, and then in between making my films. But that collaboration with other people is for me like the most enriching aspect of what I do. Like that is where I'm social. That's where I'm more challenged by other people's, you know, views and rhythms and approaches to place, to people, to time, to politics, to ethics. I learn in infinite amounts with them. I'm so proud of those films, you know. And then, slowly I make my films, and these films I'm lucky to be funded by, like, with these ones with Canada Arts Councils. But the budget is tiny. I mean, like, it's like shooting film is expensive, and I just, yeah, like big chunk of my budget goes to the sound person and the colorist, you know, and I want to collaborate more. I just, yeah, like, because I produce them, and I don't want to like produce them in a big kind of way with a production company and such. I love my slow kind of like process, you know, and that's what, something I want to keep. So we'll see if the next one, maybe we like, it has a different scenario, but yeah, it's interesting. But I love also like dealing with festivals and communicating with programmers, and I do a little bit of programming myself for festivals too, and I like that other side of things of like the festival stuff. So yeah, I like the ecosystem of what we do, and that's why it's in an effort of like include more areas into what I do, to learn and to be challenged. But of course, then the budgets are small, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the downside
of
it.
I know. maybe you won't make a lot of money with this film, but we can feel how much passion and love you put into it. And maybe this wouldn't have been possible in a different ecosystem, like you say. So yeah, thank you so much for this beautiful film.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Alan. I really, really, really appreciate your encouragement and your support. You saw you saw the film early on and your encouragement was very important. And that's it. It's like these films that are so frail in terms of their production, they live through how we move them, you know. I'm not expecting any call from any distributor anytime soon. but it's okay, you know, like it's okay. And what's important is the process of making it and the people we encountered through making it. And I hope that they can use the film for their purposes too. Some activists in the regions, they need support and they need to be visible. So I hope something can be done with them. And I think that's where more of my emphasis is there now. Mm. So.
Well, it already influenced me, and I'm sure, like you said, the audience and the activists, and so it's alive, it's there, it's a living piece now, and
I'm so glad you say that. That's the most beautiful compliment. That was my goal, and that's where I, from the beginning of this conversation, that's where I felt. When I felt that, I felt that we got somewhere, yeah. You know, and that's a good goal, that the film feels, the film thinks, the film moves, the film has dark corners and some happy ones too, that it's beautiful but difficult, and that's where the film then I was like, okay, I think you can do what you want to, what you can do, what you need to do out there.
And you liked it.
And I liked it. Yes, I was so excited. I watched it once and I was like, I think we got a film. Yeah.
You know what? I think that's the perfect conclusion for the interview.
That's it.
Thanks for listening. The Soldier's Lagoon is premiering at Cinéma du Réel and will be screened at Cartagena Film Festival, Hot Docs, Open City Documentary Festival, and many other festivals. So stay tuned for updates on where you can catch it. This episode was produced by Eileen Gökmen in Zurich, Pranav Narayan Mandahar in Tallinn, and Christina Sahayades in Brooklyn, with music by Nahim Mahbub.